둘, 셋, 파!
Borahe Army and fellow music fans, I'm Kayla.
And I'm Bethany, and we're the hosts of Standing BTS from the Consequence Podcast Network. We're a bi-weekly show that covers the impact and legacy of K-pop group BTS.
We mix the perfect blend of research and fangirl as we take a deep dive into lyrics during album reviews, theorize over music videos, and keep up with their current events.
No BTS topic is off limits. We welcome everyone into the conversation, whether you're a casual fan, committed ARMY, or someone who's just curious about one of the biggest music groups in the world.
Come chat with us every other Thursday with a new episode wherever podcasts are found.
There are some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a large unexpected inheritance. An always-on-the-verge-of-death phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone, up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard, so you can get a new one. Just trade in any phone from our top brands on any unlimited plan. With new line on my plan. Additional terms apply for trade-in and pay off your phone offer. See Verizon.com for details.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.
Hey, this is Adam from Counting Crows, and you're listening to Kyle Meredith.
Consequence Podcast Network.
And welcome to another edition of Kyle Meredith With. It's the interview series presented by WFPK at WFPK.org, Consequence and the Consequence Podcast Network. Thank you, as always, for making your way here, for checking out the episode. Please, of course, do hit that subscribe button if you're not already. You'll get three new interviews sent to you every single week, new one every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, just like this one. Great way to keep up with your favorite artists. Discover the new ones at Spotify, Apple Podcast, NPR, WFPK.org, Consequence, YouTube for the video versions, or anywhere you get your podcast from. You can subscribe to Kyle Meredith With. Don't forget to give the series a rating, leave a review as well. Some fantastic guests have dropped by lately, including Reggie Watts. The comedian has a new special called Nevermind. Ryan Tedder of One Republic, Derek Whibley of Sum 41, Juliana Hatfield, Tammy Stronach, you know her as the childlike empress from Neverending Story. She's back in Man and Witch. Victoria Justice, Minnie Driver, she's starring as Queen Elizabeth I in The Serpent Queen. Mark Gardner from Ride, Chloe Coleman from My Spy 2, The Eternal City. And we look back at a favorite interview from the late Chris Cornell. Just an example of what you get when you subscribe to the Kyle Meredith With podcast. That's me, Kyle Meredith. Today, we have a special Rewind episode, a pair of interviews with one of my all-time favorite songwriters, Adam Duritz of the Counting Crows. The first interview looks back at 2021, when the band had just released The Butter Miracle Suite Part 1, an EP with nods to The Who that found them leaning into fan-favorite, drawn-out live moments of songs like Round Here and Mrs. Potter's Lullaby, as well as talk about their impact on 2000s emo bands and the possibilities of a deluxe edition of their 1996 LP, Recovering the Satellites, maybe my favorite album of all time. From there, we head further back to 2012, where we spoke about their Outlaw Roadshow, catchy songwriting, and even his dating life in the tabloids. All that and more. It's Kyle Meredith With a Rewind episode with Adam Duritz of Counting Crows.
Hey, Kyle, how you doing?
I was talking to my wife and even my son in the past week as I was thinking about this interview, and I said at one point, I think I can tell most of my life stories by your albums, like what I was listening to at the time when you were releasing your records. So, you know, you put out some good songs through the years. It's compliments.
I'm very proud of them. And that's the best thing you can say about people's music is when it becomes the music's one of those things that's different from all the other art forms. It really does become the soundtrack to your memories. You know, our memories get really tied in with the music we were living with during those periods. It's a big deal. You know, I have to do a lot of interviews about that. So when it happens, I know it happens to me. It's like a music geek, you know. When it happens to other people with my music, that's one of the best things you can hear anyone say, you know.
Well, now I get to add another chapter into that. Because as I said, Counting Crows are back. We've got the Butter Miracle Suite 1
So I'm hoping that means of mini suites or something. But
at least two.
At least two. Yeah. When I heard this and I hit play before I even knew what I was getting into, I was told it was an EP and that was it. And then starting to realize exactly as a suite, I'm like, oh my God, it's a little mini rock opera in a way. And it seems so obvious because I feel like you guys have been building up to something like this for a long time. Like ever since, you know, I put some CDs back here. Ever since I heard Round Here on Across a Wire on that disc two from the 10 spot, and just hearing, you know, and then seeing you guys live dozens of times through the years, how you'll just build out these songs. Like it feels like it's been leading up to this for a long time. Where did the idea come from? Why did you all decide to write in this way this time?
Well, I think, you know, there are things we've been doing live with improvisations in the middle of songs, giving songs kind of different movements over the years. And I realized a few years ago that, you know, about maybe 10 years ago, that I had never really tried that to incorporate that in the writing of a song. And I really, that was a lot of what went into Palisades Park for Somewhere in Wonderland, was the idea of taking that thing we do live but putting it into the actual construction of the song itself. So it wasn't just a live thing, but, you know. This one came apart kind of differently. I think I was really burnt out for a while on the music business. Not playing so much, but just the experience of having to work in it. And I hadn't written for a while. And you know, one of the artifacts of my mental illness of the dissociation is I don't always accumulate things. I tend to not retain stuff, and I forget, especially specifically, how to play piano. Every time between records, when I haven't played much for a while, I have to kind of reteach myself to play, and it begins very rudimentarily. And I was spending a lot of time on a friend's farm out in the west of England over the last few years, and I had been out there a lot. And summer of 2019, it was actually right after I shaved my dreads. I got to England and shaved my head, and I was living out on his farm, sometimes with my girlfriend, sometimes with my friend and his family, but a lot of the time completely by myself, miles from anyone. And I wanted to play, and I rented a piano. I had a friend bring a keyboard down from London when he came down for the weekend at one point. And I started playing when I was there by myself. And I wrote this song called Tall Grass. And as I was finishing it, I was kind of playing it back to myself, and I was playing the end of the song. It kind of goes back and forth. I don't know why, I don't know why. And it's back and forth on these two chords. And I changed to a different pair of chords. And I liked the way it sounded. And this whole new melody came into my head. And I just started singing, Bobby was a kid from around the town. And I thought, oh, that's a completely different song. That's not actually part of this song. That's a different song. And I started working on it for a couple minutes. And then all of a sudden I just sort of stopped, and it hit me. Wow, what if I wrote a whole series of songs where the end of one was the beginning of the next? And that would be really interesting. That would be really cool. That sounds exciting. That actually gets me excited about writing, you know? Because like Tallgrass is very, a little dirge-like when it first starts. It gets very melodic. But part of that is just because I couldn't play very well. That's about as much as I could do when I first started writing it, you know? And a day later when I'm finishing it, I've got a lot more facility. And then by the time I get to what becomes Elevator Boots, I can sort of play piano again a little bit. And that got me really excited though. And so everything after that was kind of geared towards that. When I wrote Elevator Boots, I, you know, pushed the ending of that towards what became the beginning of Angel of 14th Street. And when I finished Angel of 14th Street, it made sure to wind up and crash down into the gun, gun, gun that starts off Bobby and the Rat Kings. The really wild thing about it though was, you know, this is the summer into the fall of 2019. So I've got this idea in my head. And when I sent the demos off to the band, I played a little bit into the next song each time so they would see what was going to go on. And so I kind of explained the concept, but I couldn't hear it. It just only in my imagination, you know? And then we started recording in Brooklyn in late February of 2020. And for just a few weeks. And the plan was we would do that for a few weeks, and then we would take like a 2-week break in early March, and we would bring the other two guitar players in, and we'd finish up. And as we were in the last couple days of recording, and we were 85% done with the record, just missing these guitar parts, we're watching the news, and the COVID's coming in the country, and I remember specifically the president at the CDC making that talk about why they were keeping people on ships, because they didn't want them in the country to bring extra infections. I mean, so that's right where we were. a couple days before we finished. So we took that 2-week break, and you know, the quarantine slammed right down in that, right before we could get started again. So we couldn't finish the record, and we sat there for like 3 months, maybe 4 months, until sometime in July. And then we just got those other two guitar players to just record their things at home or with friends at their studios in California and in Seattle. And then Immer and I live in New York, so we were already here. And my producer and engineer, they drove in from Chicago, so they didn't have to get on a plane. And we all stayed at my house, and I cooked for everybody, so no one needed to go out. And we found a studio that was like a block away, so we didn't have to take Ubers. We could just walk to work. And we laid those last guitar parts in and mixed the record. And that last day we were in there, you know, this has just been a product of my imagination all this time. And when we mixed it and finished the last mix, we cut the songs together. That's the first time I heard it. You know, you have this idea of something, but it's just in your imagination, and you're holding it there for, you know, you've done all the work for it. You know it's supposed to work. But when we cut those things together and played the four songs, the four of us sat there, or the three of us, because our engineer was gone by then. It was just the three of us. And we sat there in that room and listened to the suite. That's probably one of the most satisfying moments I've ever had in my career. I think because, I mean, to hold something that long without being able to hear it, and then to hear it, and it works. You know, it really works. It is like a world you get lost in. It is like the second side of Abbey Road. It is like a little opera, like Tommy. You know, it's very different from all those, but it's four totally different songs that play like one song. And it really works. And I mean, it's hard for me right now. I'm really excited to have people hear Elevator Boots because I do love that song. But there's a part of me that just wants them to hear the suite. And you're the first guy I've talked to today who's actually heard it.
Oh, wow.
Probably because you write for Consequence of Sound too. But other than that, the DJs, mostly radio stations, they don't just send the suite to, I guess, because none of them have heard it. And I'm kind of dying to hear what people think of the suite, you know, because that's what I've been holding in my head. That's what I've been so proud of all this time. You know, we finished it and I sent it to all my friends who are musicians and like, look what we did. Cause I'm really proud of it. It's like the coolest thing I've ever done. And you know, I got these phone calls back from, you know, some of my best friends, like Chris Caraba from Dashboard, you know, me and him and Dave Leal Pepe from Gang of Youths and our friend Sean Barna. You know, we all pass songs back and forth to each other to keep each other abreast of what we're up to. Our friend Matt Susich, too, is a songwriter. You know, we actually, you know, so they had heard all this stuff, but not in this form, you know. And, like, we're all so intimately involved with each other that way because we, you know, talk about it a lot and we're all pretty close. And, like, those guys, getting it back from those guys, man, that was, like, that put me over the moon.
And we'll be right back right after this. Welcome back. It's Kyle Meredith with Adam Duritz of Counting Crows.
I hit up a friend of mine who I knew was a big fan when Elevator Boots came out. And of course he was talking about it. And I said, it's a good song. You've got to hear it in the whole thing. And because it does, it makes so much more sense because it kind of does this. And I'll tell you that guitar riff that you were talking about right before Bobby and the Rat Kings, when he hits dun, 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 I started laughing because after all this time building up to this, I was like, there's the who right there. And then you drop a My Generation line in there and I busted out laughing. I'm like, yeah. Oh, that is so perfect.
You know, I when like those power chords, like to get to that wild, insane soloing at the end of Angel of 14th Street and the way I knew what it did musically, but I didn't write that out exactly that. And when Immer came up with that, no, 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 bum, bum, bum. Boy, when we all heard that in the studio, we all started laughing because it was so satisfying. And you know, the funny thing about the My Generation line is I didn't write it that way. I wrote it as the words My Generation doesn't even have a name of its own, but I wasn't thinking the Who thing. You know, I was just thinking about, it's kind of a joke with me because, you know, everyone talks Generation Z, Generation X, the millennials, and like, we never heard it. Then the baby boomers before us, but like, I grew up in a generation that doesn't really have a generation. And I was just thinking about that. But when I got in the studio and started singing it, when we were recording it, I was like, oh, wait, this is too good. My generation. And I did it about four different ways. Like my generation, my generation, my generation. I had a bunch of different versions of it that like hammered that point home. And I think I think it's the most subtle one in the end. It's just my generation doesn't, it's pretty simple. Yeah. But it felt good to have that little humor, especially in that song in the beginning, because there's lines in that song that are about that, like, edit and read it, instead it said it. You know, I was like trying to write hip hop lines right there. What if you repeat a rhyme that many times in a sentence? Yeah, I mean, that part really cracked me up, but we were too busy laughing from the power chords themselves, you know, like, because there's just, yeah, it's really satisfying to get there and to just like open up to those huge chords.
And then it just hits. Now, thank God you did that. That would have been a missed opportunity otherwise. And it was satisfying is the right word.
Yeah.
Getting there. You know, as the songwriter, once you figured out that you could do this style, you know, that you weren't having to write these completely full, like, it seems to me it would be a little bit of a breath, less of a burden when you figured out, oh, I don't have to write the typical repetition song, you know, verse, chorus, bridge, chorus, whatever. Because when you're writing in this style, it would seem like you can kind of just bail whenever you need to. Like if you get to a rough spot, you can go, I can go to another song.
Well, yeah, but I mean, other than Tall Grass, they're very verse, chorus in here. You know, these songs really do have like very distinctive. I can get lazy about choruses sometimes. I don't always care about writing. I write the words different every time. Like these songs really have choruses. Like that Elevator Boots choruses, you know, like I really worked on those. But the weird thing about it was like, they're so different, all four of these songs. You know, I was really writing in almost like a British folk music, Nick Drakey vibe at the beginning for Tall Grass, you know? And then when I got so excited when I started playing Elevator Boots, and I really wanted it to be this kind of glam Mata Hoople thing, which, you know, that's a big part throughout it with the guitars. I really wanted those, like, Immer and I talked about that, those Mata Hoople, Mick Ronson-y guitars, you know. But then it was like, I remember being in the one of the guys who works on the farm's pickup truck. We were going into town to buy some groceries one time, and I heard this new Bombay Bicycle Club song on the radio on BBC, and it was just like, kind of, it was a little trancey and kind of dancey with a melody line on a keyboard. And it's weird. I went back to try and figure out what song that was like a few months ago, so a year later, because I was curious, because it really did inspire Angel of 14th Street. And I can't find it. I mean, I know it's there. I know it's one of these songs, but none of them sounded anything like Angel of 14th Street, so I'm not sure. But I remember very much that like the vibe, the kind of dance club vibe of this song is really what inspired me when I started Angel 14th Street, but I can't find anything that sounds anything like it. So I don't know what it was. But you know, it's like, that's a whole different kind of set of inspirations than Mata Hoople. And then when I got to Bobby and the Rat Kings, it's kind of back to Mata Hoople with a good solid taste of the Who, I guess, kind of in there, you know, like I just wanted power chords. I can sometimes write really esoterically, and I don't always do the simple things. And I really wanted to just like, big chords where someone can go, you know, like in the, or I wanted people to play air guitar when they hear it, you know.
It's different than all the air piano that we've played in the past. We finally get that moment. I guess we get that little bit of hanging around, but it's not exactly the same thing. I get what you're saying there. Lyrically then, did it make sense for you? Did you need to tell a complete story from front to back then if it's working like that? I mean, does it?
No, not really. I didn't think about it at all. I mean, I think they kind of do in a way. I was having a lot of trouble when I had to do the track by track for this recording, because I couldn't think of anything to say about them. They just kind of seem like what they are. I mean, their stories are really different. The only two that really are related in a certain way is, I do think that Elevator Boots and Bobby and the Rat Kings very much are different sides of the same coin. They're telling a story about like the how important music is in my life and how important being a music geek is. And one of them kind of tells the prescription, because music is affected my life in two very different ways. One, I've been a huge music fan and a geek all my life, where I just am obsessed with music. And the other hand, I actually do it professionally. That's my job, and I've done it. I make it myself, and other people relate to me that way, like I relate to my favorite musicians, you know? And so I think that Elevator Boots really talks about that from the perspective of the guy in the band. And Bobby and the Rat Kings really talks about it from the perspective of the guy in love with the band, who like has had these moments in his life, these very moments that I tell the story of in those songs, that were very like soundtracked by music he loved, even though it's a fictional band. But like, you know, I think overall in some ways it tells a story about me getting back into being interested in playing music again, but that was not an intention. I never really think about things like that. I don't think about themes when I write. Whenever I try to do that, it comes out really trite. But I, you know, I do tend to you can look at a record later on and look back on it and see there always are themes, because, you know, it's your life and you're writing about how you feel about things, and that changes from year to year. And on this given record, you can see themes in them, but they're never really intentional for me. But I don't really know how to talk. I learned to talk about my records and what I think of my records while I'm doing interviews for my records, because I'm kind of forced to. And then that makes me think about it. And I come up with ideas because I don't think about it otherwise. They have to hold essential truth every song. They really do. They have to hold. But you know that when you're writing it, you know, and you just make sure it stays true to where you are. But I don't know that I know what any of them are about thematically until I look back on them much later.
It's interesting, too, because as a fan of the Counting Crows, of your writing specifically, one of the things that we get to do is a lot of train spotting in your songs. You know, the lines that you put here that reference a song that's, you know, from the last album or 25 years ago or something like that. You know, I wrote down in Tall Grass. I don't even know if you mean to do this, but of course, as the fan now, my eyes are open looking for these things when you say, can you see me? Because I'm changing. Two songs instantly come to mind. Have You Seen Me Lately and All My Friends. You know, are those things running through your mind as you're doing them?
And there was also a part of like the outro, I think, of Miller's Angels that was like that. I don't know, but I think that like how we perceive ourselves and how other people perceive us, and especially being a famous person, how different those two things can be. It was inevitably going to be a theme of my writing because I've lived it specifically. You know, like I've had a very skewed view of myself. And when you're dissociative, a big artifact of that is that you look at yourself from a distance a lot, that you have a really hard time being in your body, that like a lot of your view of yourself is and other people is from a distance. And, you know, so I think that has been a common theme of concern. I know there's the outro of Miller's Angels has that, can't you see me? Cause I'm dreaming. Mm-hmm. I think it's like, it's something I've improvised a lot in Round Here and Rain King probably. I don't know that I thought about that at all. When I was writing Tall Grass, I was wondering what you were going to say just now when you were saying, you know, you spotted something, but like, yeah, but that is in those songs that thematically is, it kind of, that's what I mean about like, you're bound to have themes because you wrote them all that year, and that's a year for you where you felt a certain way, and you're bound to have themes because it's your life, you know, and so things are going to crop back up again, whether it's the name Elizabeth or Maria, or it's the idea of, can you see me? Because it, you know, your changing experience with that comes out in your songs, you know, accidentally or on purpose. It's part of who you are.
It's interesting how, for me at least, how the timing works on all that too. You know, I got that Recovering the Satellites record back here. Maybe that's my all-time favorite record. I don't know. Maybe. It could be. It could be. This is the anniversary year, I know, for something like that. And I, you know, looking back at a lot of those songs with these songs, but with I'm Not Sleeping, with Have You Seen Me Lately, with a lot of those that would go on to be talked about by a lot of bands who will, you know, associate themselves as emo. We'll say emo bands. Those are the songs they're pointing to that said, this is what made our scene. I couldn't see that then, but I'm sure you're aware of that. There have been these tribute albums by these emo bands. What was it like kind of seeing it take off in that direction?
Well, it was really strange at the time because I thought we'd become kind of, in a lot of critics' eyes and a lot of the sort of, we had become kind of a joke to a lot of people in the, whatever you want to call it, the cognoscenti about music, you know, like pow people, but not to musicians. Like to musicians, we were a deeply important band. And I remember before I knew Chris, hearing about like reading interviews with Chris Carrabba, you know, when the first few Dashboard records came out, and how declarative he was about how important we were, how important Angels of the Silences was to him. And at a time when it wasn't really cool to be a fan of our band, he was very vocal about it. Bands like Between the Buried and Me, I remember on one of the tribute albums, Panic at the Disco. And those guys always really talking about the playing rock and roll with the real emotionality, not necessarily with earnestness, not with cynicism or sarcasm, and how deeply influenced they were for it. But it came at a time when a lot of people just didn't feel that way about our band and didn't respect the band at all. I really remember reading, it was in like Alternative Press, and reading this whole, it was one article about Dashboard. And there was a big sidebar article in the article that said, do we all have it wrong about Counting Crows? You know, like, everybody thinks Counting Crows is a joke, but Chris Carrabba won't stop talking about Counting Crows. Do we all have it wrong about Counting Crows? Do we need to re-examine this stuff? And I was like, well, yeah. Yeah, I think so. But, you know, yeah, so that was always, you know, but I know there's a difference between musicians and everybody else too. I understand. I've always known that, like, rock and roll and music in general is our personal cool. You know, we wear it on t-shirt, literally wear it on t-shirts. We, not just our hearts on our sleeves.
Sunflower Bean's a great band, by the way.
Fellow New Yorkers. I love those guys. They're so good. Julia is a genius. But you know, it is a big part of how we define ourselves, and as a result of that, how we define ourselves as being different from those guys over there. I rock, you suck, and you suck and you listen to that, so I rock, so I don't. But musicians aren't that way. They just tend to like music. They tend to be really geeky about music. Musicians are always former music geeks. Sometimes I think critics are music geeks who grow up and become football players. They become the jocks who pick on the music geeks. But, you know, so yeah, that was pretty clear to me that we were a pretty big influence. You know, and there's still a bunch of my closest friends are other musicians. You know, that's one of the reasons I love putting on Underwater Sunshine Festival, because it brought me back to having a peer group. We all do, these people understand me because we do the same thing. You know, me, like Sean, my friend Sean Barna, Matt Susich, Chris Carrabba, Dave Leal Pepe from Gang of Youths, we pass stuff back and forth. We sit around and talk to each other. We sing on each other's records. Maria Taylor, you know, I mean, the festival's been great that way for me. It's been like, and the Outlaw Roadshow before that, because it really brought me back in touch with a lot of musicians, because you have that when you're starting out, but you really lose it unless you want to go to the MTV Awards or the Grammys, and I'm not really, it's not my bag. You just don't have that peer group anymore. So getting that back was great for me. And I love that. I've sung on a ton of records in the last few years, but they're almost all just friends of mine, you know, and they're brilliant, but some of them are like Chris are famous and others aren't. Leo Pepe, Dave may be becoming very famous, because I mean, they're already the biggest band in Australia. They open for the Foos over here. I'm really hoping they blow up, because they're the best.
I've seen them a few times. They're fantastic.
Yeah, that's the best rock and roll band I've seen in a decade. They're so good. I went over and sang all this stuff on their new record when I was in London, when I was in England during that time, because he and I are very, very close. And I sang on, I don't know, four songs, maybe three or four songs. And then they trashed the whole thing. They want to start over. So I'm like, okay, well, just save their space, because I'm going to be back. As soon as I can travel, I'm going to be back. I want to go to the farm, but I'm definitely coming to sing on the Gang of Youth record. Oh, I do want to mention one more thing. It's really important to me, because Dave Drago is a big part of this record. My friend Dave Drago used to be in a band that was in the Outlaw Roadshow called Tallahassee, but he has a studio up in Rochester called 1809 Studios, and he produced Sean Barna's record Sissy, which I sang on a few years ago, and I was blown away by the background vocals he did on it and how cool and glam they were. They really reminded me of like those Mott the Hoople records and the Bowie stuff, like Hunky Dory era stuff and Ziggy Stardust, and I just loved his composition and his singing. And when we finished that first bunch of recording, Immer and I put a few background vocals on it. We didn't have anything really great. We had a few things that were really cool, but we didn't have something that brought the record to life the way I wanted it to. And so when I'd been stuck at home for about a month, I called Dave and said, hey, I'm going to send you this new record. It's not finished yet, but I want you to write and sing for it. And I sent him all the stems after that. And we spent the next like month, you know, sometime in May maybe, or early June, passing ideas back and forth over the phone and over Zoom. And he sings about 90 to 95% of the background vocals on this record. We finished them all over that break. That's one thing we could do, and we did them. And I think they're out of this world. It's a big part of making this record what I dreamed about it being, was him really coming through on his composition, the writing of those background vocals, and the singing of them. Like, he just did incredible stuff. More than we needed. We had to tone it back, because there was like 12 part harmonies. We had to pull them back some. And when I say, considering Angel of 14th Street, that we pulled them back some, you could just imagine where that was at one point, because it was a C. It was really, I mean, he just did great work. And we're actually working on another record right now. He and I, Immer too, Sean Barna's new record, which is incredible. We're just trying to finish it right now. Immer plays on it a bunch, bass and guitar. I sing on it a bunch, like on 3 or 4 different songs. It's really cool.
Yeah, it's interesting. That background vocal thing, the timing. My next interview, it's tomorrow, it's with Jacob Dylan. It's the 25th anniversary of Bringing Down the Horse, too. You know, he's got his new record with the Wallflowers, but I thought, and there you are, singing on everybody's record, you know.
Well, I really love doing it. You know, I kind of was, that's what I was doing in Dave Bryson's studio. He had a studio called Dancing Dog in Berkeley, or Emeryville, actually, in a warehouse. And one of the ways I got friends with a lot of musicians back then was I would sing background vocals on people's records when we were just starting out in the Himalayans and then later in Counting Crows. It's how I ended up in Sordid Humor in that band. That's how I met what's his name? Everclear. Art Alexakis. Because he had a band called Colorfinger, I think, and I sang on his record back in early '90s. You know, '91 maybe. I've always really, I love like make being that thing that makes some other piece of music just pop, you know. And some of my proudest moments in music are like that one I did with Nancy Griffith, going back to Georgia. The Wallflowers one's great. The Chris Carrazza, the one on Dashboard Confessional, that So Long, So Long, that's one of my favorite background vocals I've ever done. Or that one, my friend Matt Susich, his new record, I don't know if you've heard that. He's like a great New York folk songwriter. He's like the modern Paul Simon. He's so good. And he has a song, I sang on 3 or 4 songs on this record, but he has a song called I Don't, where it's kind of like a duet, and it's beautiful, you know, and it's really cool. I'd love that stuff. I'd love singing background vocals.
I'll have to check that. I'll quickly ask, just for my own geek dreams, is there a deluxe edition of this ever happening, like the August collection?
Yes, I think so. It has been a struggle. I've been trying to do this for about 15 years, ever since the 10th anniversary, because we did a ton of stuff on that record. Not extra tracks, but we filmed all this stuff. The Jonathan Dayton and Valerie Ferris, who made Little Miss Sunshine, filmed a mini documentary on us while we were recording. Josh Taft, who made the video for Alive for Pearl Jam, filmed the very first concert when we did that record, and the video for Angels of the Silences. So we have that. Then we did the Storytellers and the Live at the 10 spot, which were both filmed. So we've had this package that could be a really cool deluxe package. And I'm not kidding when I tell you it's been almost 20 years I've been trying to get this stuff from Geffen, and they just made this excuse or that excuse. Now, I know for a fact that they lost the master tapes a long, long time ago, before the fire. They had already lost the master tapes to satellites. They're gone.
Oh, wow.
But then this fire happened, and it seemed like they might have lost everything and just not told any of us. But recently they've been sort of hinting that they think they have a lot of things and they'll get them all for us. They haven't produced anything yet, but they say they're doing it. And it seems like they're saying it differently than they have in the past. So the only thing that's held that back from having deluxe edition is the complete failure of our record company to keep any of it. we're trying to find out, because I would really like to put that out. It would be a deluxe edition based in a bunch of film stuff as opposed to extra tracks, because they weren't really... Well, the extra tracks are definitely gone because that was all lost. But we'll see. I don't know. We are really trying to get that together But I've been trying to do that since the 10th anniversary. The 15th, the 20th, now it's 25. It's been a lot of years of the record company... I mean, and we all know now there was this huge fire that they didn't tell us about for a long time. So it's impossible to know how much was lost. We're trying to find out. It could just be that they don't have anything filed away organized, because it does seem like there's a problem with that in those record companies. They don't care about that.
So sad to hear those extra tracks are gone. But just the same, like I said, I love that, you know, that era and that album. I mean, I love them all, but especially that. I'll pay. I'll shill. Whatever you want to do. I'm there.
Well, I'd like to.
In the meantime, congratulations. Pulling it back into the present here with Butter Miracle Sweet One. It's so good, Adam. It's so good. I can't wait to hear what comes for Sweet 2 through 13 and all the ones after that. Thank you for taking the time to talk about it, man.
Oh, man. Thank you. I'm so glad to talk to someone who's heard it. This is the best part of my day. Absolutely. Thank you.
Awesome.
Really.
Take care. And hopefully we'll get to talk on the next one, too.
All right. Thanks, man.
And we'll be right back right after this. That was our interview from 2021. As I mentioned, now we head back to 2012 for part 2 of Kyle Meredith with Adam Duritz of Counting Crows.
How are you?
You're on the Outlaw Road Show.
It's a busy day.
Yeah. We were just talking off camera, like, this really is kind of
it's not your entire creation, but you're, I mean, you have been overseeing so much of this, so, right?
Well, me and Ryan Spaulding, who runs Ryan's Smashing Life blog, and we sat down together and found bands we wanted to tour with. A lot of them have played on the Outlaw Road show, you know, in one of our showcases before. Right. And planned out a tour. I you know, went through it and handpicked all the venues because I kind of wanted a little different venue. I wanted a place that, not just the normal cookie cutter sheds, I wanted a little smaller because, you know, we're not depending on any other bands to sell tickets in the store, really. So right. I wanted a little smaller, but also because I wanted you to be able to, like, I wanted the audience to get into the bands. I wanted a place that was more fun to play and also fun to see a show at. So I kind of went through everything that was suggested by our agents and looked them up online and looked at the pictures of the place. And you can't see everything all the time, but you can see some stuff, you know, and you can read comments too, what people say about going to shows. It worked out pretty well too. I mean, our kind of model was the Greek Theater in Berkeley and Red Rocks, right. You know, places that are sort of unique, right. Different, a little smaller than like the 15,000, like 7,000 to 10,000, and just have a little unique sort of sensibility about them. Mm-hmm. And there, you know, we found them all over the country.
We should say we're at the Iroquois Amphitheater here in Louisville, too. Yeah. And I guess what is amazing about all of that is, at this point in a lot of musicians' career, you say, right, tour, put me through the machine, whatever. But, you saying you handpicked all of these venues and did all the homework and on and on. It's impressive.
You know, it's kind of like, I think in a way, I'm not sure it's true that, the longer you go on, it'd be easy to say you take care of it, but the longer you've been around doing this, the more you know not to do that kind of.
Right.
I mean, if you really want to enjoy yourself or have anything that's not just a huge headache, it's best not to just leave it, unless you know everyone working with you is completely on top of it. But I mean, I know our crew is completely on top of it.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'd say our agents were really good about finding the kind of places I was looking for. And being understanding when I said no to places.
You're introducing these cool bands. You know, a lot of people haven't heard a lot of these bands. I mean, even two of the bands on this bill, I knew Good Old War, but you know, I didn't know Foreign Fields or Filigar. But so, do you use the bands to help get the word out, or do you also hope to suck a little bit of their marrow out for your own spirit?
But yeah, I mean, I don't know. The thing is, we're an independent band now too, so educating people about going to places where independent music is played. You know, the day trotters, the different blogs of the world, about looking online for things as opposed to just on the radio. Mm-hmm. It's going to help us too.
Right.
Because, and then, you know, of course, there's the ritual blood sucking of just like taking their spirit and their souls and stealing it.
I saw Madonna do that once on television. You know?
More than once, I'm sure.
It has been a little while now between records, between Saturday night, Sunday mornings, and now, and it feels like a lot's happened, and then it also feels like nothing has happened, I guess. From the fans' point of view, from, you know, looking out, I guess I just read a recent interview, you were talking about this whole med problem that you run. You're coming off of these prescription pills.
Well,
did that play a part of just taking time between records?
Well, probably somewhat, although, actually, no, because when I was doing that was right when we were making the record and I was working on the play. It was all happening exactly the same time, so I was busy. I mean, you know, I've had a lot of troubles with mental illness, and for a while there, it was just necessary to have me on a bunch of these medications just to be able to cope,
sure.
To be safe. But, you know, they don't want me to stay on that stuff forever, and so last year, a lot of it's for people who are bipolar, which I'm not, but they were probably making it kind of safe. But then, you know, sort of got another consultation, and someone said, you know, probably, I can see why you might have been on these meds at one point, but they're not going to let you get better. And they're not going to help you write because they, you know, they're very bad with creativity and memory.
Right.
Well, two things that you kind of use.
Like,
so,
how do you write? You're writing on them and then you're writing off of them, and so there is a big difference.
I don't know, but apparently it's not easy to write on them, and I wasn't having an easy time writing for a while there. But last year, I mean, we did a covers album, but that's because I was working on the play too. Mm-hmm. I was working on this theater piece, so I did a lot of writing for that. So I mean, it wasn't really like I took a year off songwriting there. I was really working writing, but we were just not for Counting Crows. And it was too hard to think about writing for two different things at the same time. We recorded in like April and May, or April, and then we went back and recorded in June, and then in July or August I went and did the theater piece. So I mean, it's all in the midst of the worst of all this stuff. Sure. Was right when I was doing all this, going through all the med stuff, was right when we were doing all the work too.
Probably not a bad idea that you did a covers record then, that it ended up like that.
Well, I mean, it was a covers record or not do one, because I don't even think in the best of times I could write for two separate things at the same time. It's too hard to write. How would you decide what goes where, you know?
Sure.
So, you know, I was just doing the theater piece. That's why we did the covers out, so we could still keep working. Mm-hmm. I mean, well, I'm surprised we got any of it done at all, because I was a wreck, you know, but I think sometimes when you're like that, it's good to focus on stuff.
Sure.
So I think the work was probably really good.
So is there a point we can expect another originals record? Is that also in the work,
yeah,
or is that still down the road?
Well, I mean, it's not today.
It's not today.
I mean, I'm not really big on
that. Did you bring that in?
Yeah, just like working this afternoon. And all the reams of free time we've got.
Man, what a scoop.
Well, I mean, I'm sure we'll make one. I never really know we're going to make a record tour when we go and do it. Because there's not much planning that goes into that. I mean, well, there is, just, I guess nowadays, try it. But we've been doing that all year long. We've been looking into places to set up our studio. Because
right,
we kind of own all the equipment ourselves since our second record. We never made records in studios until the second record. So we're just kind of looking for some spaces to like have running all the time so we can record really cheaply.
Because
we have everything, might as well do it that way. But that's been ongoing.
Yeah, one of the most interesting things about your style of songwriting is it does feel it's really autobiographical. I mean, you put a lot into it.
Yeah.
Or at least it's been written a lot about like that. Anyway,
no, I mean, sure.
A lot of speculation.
It's not necessarily like a diary. It's all about how I feel about things. Not necessarily, it's not like everything's a true story. I mean, if all you had to do is write what happened, well, it would just, you have to just go lead an adventurous life and then write about it. But, I mean, it definitely is about how I feel about things.
Yeah.
I don't feel the need to make it be. And then at 3 o'clock.
Well, no, does it ever get this too personal where you write something and you're like, you know what, that is way too personal that I either have to cloak it or I have to just, I don't want that out there.
No, not really. I think that closest it comes to anything like that is probably, well, to me that would always be a plus in the writing. The more personal it was, the more revealing it was, that would seem like a better song.
Yeah.
It would seem like a better song then when we were recording it. It would be when you'd have to go out and play it every night that,
right,
you might not feel like doing that every night.
Yeah.
But, you know,
have you ever regretted a few of the songs that you end up having to go out and you're like, oh, man.
No, it's more just like that it can be kind of, if you're not in the right frame of mind, you really have to scrape it out of yourself with our songs because there's a lot in them. And that can be, that was sort of a nightmare when the meds were, when I was having trouble with the meds because it was, I couldn't necessarily access the feelings, and so I'd have to go in there and like scrape it out. It's like working out without having eaten.
Sure.
You sort of feed on yourself, and that's pretty unpleasant. And the more unpleasant the song, the worse that is. But not really. I mean, I don't really get tired of any of our songs too much because if I don't want to play a song, I'm just more likely not to play it. Especially after 20 years. Like, you just don't want to play the same thing over and over again for 20
years.
Yeah,
20 years in, though, and especially even now, I think with the name The Outlaw Roadshow on tagged onto this, it makes me kind of wonder, do you see yourself as an entertainer or a traveling salesman?
Well, I don't know. I suppose it's a little bit both.
Or is that exclusive? Or either, or are those exclusive?
Well, it's, you know, it's still just like being in a band. I suppose, you know, look, I mean, there's definitely a, I think you owe people things. I'm just not sure it's what they think you owe them. Like, I think you owe people the show every night.
Right.
And you owe it a certain quality. I don't think you owe them, I think that's what I think you owe them. You owe them the best possible show every night. And to me, the best way to do that is to not be playing stuff that I don't want to play.
Mm-hmm.
Because then I think you're, it might be fine for some people, but I'm not good at it. When I don't want to play a song, I'm not great at playing it.
Right.
I'm really good at it when I really want to play it. And then it's like, it's very emotional. But I don't feel like I owe anybody like specific songs on a given night, and I've got too many songs to worry too much about that. Because it just seems like, well, that's just not who we are. We've been real clear about it from the beginning. So, you know, people come. I heard someone, you know, mostly, strangely, we don't get any much complaints about it anymore. I think I've read about 3 or 4 tweets this tour from people who just did object to us not playing around here some night, or objected to us not playing Mr. Jones.
Right.
But mostly not. Somebody, like, somebody made a comment.
Those fringe fans.
Oh, I just think they're fans, you know, maybe they haven't seen a bunch of shows.
Yeah.
Not necessarily fringe, just like they're expecting something different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because, you know, if you're going to see a lot of bands and they all do it the other way, I can see why you'd expect that. You know, and I don't really object to it, I'm just not necessarily going to do it.
Sure.
You know, but
sure.
But somebody wrote on a Twitter thing last tour, you know, he was annoyed that we didn't play it, and he said, remember what got you here. But I wrote back to him, like, you know what, the truth is, what got us here after 20 years is always playing good shows.
Right.
And always playing what we want to play on stage is how we do that. Mr. Jones didn't get us here.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Jones didn't even get us there in the first place. Round Here did. Because Round Here is the one we played on Saturday Night Live first, and that's what we played on Letterman.
Right.
And that's when we blew ourselves up. Mr. Jones was we weren't in the top 200 before that.
Yeah.
So I mean, to that extent, Mr. Jones is a song I absolutely love that's, you know, was a radio hit. But radio isn't the be-all, end-all center of culture. We were here 20 years later because people want to come see the
right
show and all that. ways we ruin our songs, if you want to call it that. Everything we didn't mess around with.
You mentioned the radio hits, too. That's another interesting thing part of your career, because you guys, you know, if you do take some years between records, you know, you kind of come in and out of the public consciousness, I guess. But you usually do come back every now and then with a big radio hit, and that's got to be something new for a generation. But does it feel different every time? Like when you come back and, you hit with the cover with Big Yellow Taxi, and that was, you know, a few years after the last one and everything like that. Does it feel different when a hit actually comes through at this point?
No, it feels exactly the same every time, which is kind of peripheral and like I didn't have anything to do with it.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, because I don't really listen to radio very much, so I kind of don't care which song it is. And for years, I sort of let the record label do it. I mean, I was the one who insisted on Mr. Jones, as opposed to they wanted Murder of One. They didn't want Mr. Jones as a single.
It's interesting.
So, but show me your name on that. They don't necessarily know everything they're doing out there. You know, I was right about that one.
Right, right.
Although not because I thought it was a big hit. I just thought it was a good introductory song. Mm-hmm. But I think I was right about that. That's what it did. It introduced the public to us, opened them up in a way, and then we went on and played around here and crushed. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what we did. But, you know, it's just so freakish when it happens. I mean, we had a hit with Occidentally Love. Mm-hmm. I love that song. It's a great song. But it's a hit because that's a massive, massive movie.
Sure.
You know, and the other
one... But it doesn't hurt that it's a catchy song.
No, if it was a terrible... But you know what? Terrible songs get on the air, too.
They can do that.
Often because they're catchy.
Right.
You know, but, I mean, you can't really weigh that as a quality gauge for you.
If you name it the press, anyway.
Sure, it's a good thing. I know people think all press is good press. I'm not a believer in that.
Well, I think when you're at the receiving end of it, though...
Well,
it's a bit different.
Well, I don't think it's good for you, either. I think that music's different from everything else because you wear music, like, not only like your clothes... Mm-hmm. But you do wear it as your clothes.
Sure, sure.
But I mean, you wear music like your personal cool in a way you don't with anything else.
Mm-hmm.
Not with fine arts, not with movies. You don't go back to them over and over again. You don't talk about them with your friends.
Mm-hmm.
You don't like, it's part of the scene you're in. There's so many ways in which music is a part of your personal cool. So negatives of music, I don't think are good. I think they're really bad. But whatever, time passes. There's no way to escape it your whole career.
Sure.
It happens with everything. You know, it's because the culture's much more around. Gossip and is around music most of the time, unfortunately.
And you've lived through plenty of that.
Both, yeah. Mostly so imaginary, but yeah. My love life and the imagination of the press.
Well, it's got to be nice not being in the tabloids as much these days, so that's...
Well, yeah, I mean, I didn't do most of the stuff that got me in the first place, but...
So but the legend is great.
You float in, you float out. People's imaginations.
Well, it's great to see you guys doing so well, especially independently these days. Underwater Sunshine. That's fun, you know, to see you guys actually have fun like that. So stretching out.
That's the reason we're not on tablets. We can pick and choose exactly how we want to be, where we want to be all the time. And the outlets that we talk to, I mean, it's a lot less likely with you than it is with even Rolling Stone, which is much more of a gossip mag than it used to be.
Cool.
You know. It's a nice thing about this world is that you can just choose where you go to.
Yeah.
You pick your friends. It's much nicer.
Well, appreciate you picking this one.
Thanks.
Taking some time today, Adam.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. And there it is, Rewinding with Adam Duritz of Counting Crows. My thanks to Adam. Hoping that we hear part two of that Butter Miracle Suite here soon. Thanks to you for checking out the episode. Again, hit that subscribe button before you get out of here so you can keep up with all the interviews that we put out every single week. A new one every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. You can grab us at Spotify, Apple Podcast, NPR, WFPK.org, Consequence, YouTube for the video versions, or anywhere you get your podcast from. Subscribe to Kyle Meredith With. Give a rating, leave a review if you feel so inspired as well. And then head over to WFPK.org, where I do a show Monday through Friday, starting at 6 p.m. Eastern. 4 hours of classics from the 80s and 90s. You get the best in new music, bonus interviews, lots of music news as well. One of my recent shows featured some classics and favorites from Visage, Midgeur, Vampire Weekend, Scott Weiland, Morrissey, Southern Culture on the Skids, The Killers, Lou Reed, Mystic, Astro Gilberto, Linda Ronstadt, The Clash, Blonde Shell, Bully, Common, Pete Rock, The Heavy, Patti Smith, Catherine Will, Faith No More, and my interview with Rufus Wainwright. Just an example of what you can hear every weeknight starting at 6 p.m. Eastern at WFPK.org. Consequence has your music and film news. You can also find me on any of the social media sites. The address is always the same. It's at Kyle Meredith. I do hope you like and follow along. And that does it for another edition. I'm Kyle Meredith. I'll see you next time.
Consequence Podcast Network.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.
There are some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with. like a large unexpected inheritance. An always-on-the-verge-of-death phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone, up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard, so you can get a new one. Just trade in any phone from our top brands on any unlimited plan. With new line on my plan. Additional terms apply for trade-in and pay off your phone offer. See Verizon.com for details.